Thank you. Special guest this evening, Dhanadhar Swami has agreed to also sit on a chair, so kindly pardon the chairs. Would you join me in welcoming our guest this evening, Dhanadhar Swami? Thank you very much for being here. Since we have the opportunity here to kind of take advantage of the circulation of VIPs who come through New York, last week we had Radhanath Swami here, and this week we have Dhanadhar Swami. So this is Dhanadhar Swami's third time here?
Three times.
Second,
and third,
something like that. Yeah. Eternal, each time has been eternal. What we thought we'd do is continue that format that seemed to work very well last week of doing this as a discussion, and that way we can open up more quickly to questions and dialogue. Okay? So let me take the initiative, if I may, just before we get started, to go around the room and introduce some of our friends, since most of the people here are kind of like very close family, and some of you have met before. I usually start on my left, so I'm going to start on my right. You're up. Just say hello to Dhanadhar Swami and give your name. And glad you're here this week.
Julie, welcome.
Julie's a wonderful teacher here at Julie Mukti.
I'm Rush. Yeah.
Thank you for joining us.
Nice to see you.
Welcome, Rush. I'm
Gail. Glad you're here as well.
I'm Hamish.
Welcome.
Hi, Paul.
Kind is kind of one of the pillars of the New York Bhakti community, if you haven't gotten familiar with her yet.
That's very generous of you to say, probably not true, but you need encouragement.
Jaideep is also a regular now for, how long have you been coming? A year or so, huh? About a year. And Cher, of course.
Welcome back.
And Robert.
Welcome. My name's Robert.
Lovely shirt you have on. So we had a chance to sit in the cafe and chat for a little while before getting started this evening. And I think we share a certain sense of wonder over how things have evolved and where we are as a devotional community in the world today. And because it's a small enough group, I think we can take absolutely brazen, presumptuous attitudes here toward the kinds of questions that we ask Dhanadhar Swami. I do warn you in advance, however, we have an online population of extensive listeners around the world. So
hi. Right?
So this will be broadcast internationally. I wanted to start just by asking what, to my mind, might be some of the obvious questions that people here would have and might not be quite so outrageous as I am to just ask. So let me start by candidly asking you a question. You wear the robes of a monk, you are a monk, you've been a monk for a long time, and yet, you know, go back far enough and, you know, you're a Brooklyn boy like me.
I didn't know you had such a high birth.
Oh my God. Absolutely. Only pedigree here.
I thought you were from Manhattan.
Oh, well. That was later.
Okay.
What on earth prompted you, you know, to give up, you know, all of the promises of the world to take to a devotional, renounced path? I mean, what were you thinking?
I'd like to explain a little bit maybe about, like, a religious experience. And I think anyone moves any place when they have trust and faith. And just Prabhupada, my guru, gave the best definition of faith. It's to trust in something sublime. So you go wherever you think there's sublimity. That's why people practice yoga here. That's why they go to a sports game. That's why they do anything. They have trust that that's where they'll find their happiness. So I came to a spiritual, you know, somehow or other, I'm not sure. I don't think I was planning that necessarily. Do you know what I did before, my last job before I became a monk?
Rabbi? No.
Close. I was a high school sports coach.
That's about the, that's a rabbi. High school sports coach.
Yeah, I was. And somehow I took pilgrimage in 1970 to California. And I met people of the tradition and participated in the chanting just kind of naturally and spontaneously.
We're talking about Krishna devotees?
Yeah, Krishna devotees. And then I had a experience of a happiness that was so supra-sensuous, supra-egotistical, but more pleasure and more happiness than I could imagine. So naturally that moved me in that direction, because that's where people go. Mm-hmm. And the movement in that direction was also supported by a worldview and an understanding that gave me confidence that it was the right thing to do also. So I think those two things, and I moved in that direction.
Can I ask what you mean by sensuous and egotistical? How is encounter
qualified? It's something like... generally, kind of the two pleasures I was seeking before was some sensual pleasure, right? Or some ego gratification, that I'm better than people, or I won an award, or my team won, or, you know, things like that. And this type of pleasure was kind of a spiritual love, you know, some kind of real deep feeling of the heart, of inner happiness and satisfaction.
Because I suspect the other question that people have but would never ask, and so I will, is if you're a monk, that means you must be celibate. And I find it fascinating that you would describe the experience of encountering devotees, and I assume they were chanting, as a sensual experience. Is it...
I said above that.
Above... Supra-sensual.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
so then...
That's super.
Supra-sensual. We might assume, and I don't want to be, guessing people's future here, but that path may not be cut out for everybody. I mean, is there something that you could tell us about what it's like being a monk? As many, how long have you been a monk now in Krishna tradition?
Let's see, I Thirty-nine years.
Okay. So, you know, if people are thinking, I want to progress spiritually, you know, I want to get out of Maya, I want to get out of the material scene, you know, do I have to follow that path of renunciation in order to get there?
I mean, actually speaking, I think the fact that I'm a monk, in one sense, it's different than that I am a devotee. In the sense that there's this experience, some kind of religious experience, that is supported by kind of an understanding that encourages that you're going forward and doing the right thing and just the way you live your life, you get kind of a fruit of nourishing that experience. But I think that's my proclivity. Or something. I think different people have different proclivities. So somehow I have a proclivity to be a monk. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that is the standard of what makes someone advance in spiritual life. It's just how I execute that.
Okay. Man, remember one of the reasons why that comes so obviously to mind is not just because for many people the idea of giving up sex and the sensual life is a little intimidating. But also, you know, if you look around at the posters in this room and you think about the great names, you know, of the spiritual heritages of the world, they generally tend to be celibates. They tend to be monks, renunciates. And maybe there's an impression that can be, you know, derived from that's... that's some kind of a prerequisite. Can one be both in the world and not of the world? Can you know God and still be a part of the rest of the world?
As far as my understanding is, there's three ways you can approach the world. You can indulge yourself without restriction, you can renounce it, and you can use it. Bhakti is using it and dedicating it. And different people have different proclivities, so they use them.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow or other, I'm a monk. Mm-hmm. And obviously, in one sense, it offers... I think when things are material, and you know whether you're celibate or not, it's kind of material. But I think they offer a benefit, and then there's also a downside. Mm-hmm. You know, there's both sides to it. So, I mean, the benefit is that obviously... maybe the sports thing. I was so dedicated. So I just became dedicated. I was very dedicated before. I was the most dedicated player. So I got very dedicated.
You still are.
What?
Just changed
I
uniform.
Just changed the thing.
I see.
Well, actually, he asked me, Michael, he said, you know, someone asked me about T-Lock. Why do you wear T-Lock? I said, it's a uniform. Mm-hmm. A uniform does two things. It gives you a certain mood, and people can identify you. Yes, maybe I was attached to uniforms.
Mm-hmm. But
the point is, it obviously, in one sense, there's a facility for it. You know, the facility for it is that you could dedicate yourself, mm-hmm. you know, with, I guess, I don't know, more fully, but in a way, mm-hmm. you can, you know, concentrate on it in a way that perhaps you can't. You're working outside, et cetera.
Right.
But there's other advantages to that, too.
Well, two things that you said that really jump out for me. One is, and it was almost in passing, that renounced or not renounced is a material designation. That's a fascinating observation, that that's material. That's almost irrelevant. Where's your heart? Where's your dedication?
Well, you can be completely renounced. Right? You can be completely renounced and have no devotion.
Mm.
Even Prabhupada, when he talked about celibacy, he said,
Well, isn't there a verse in the Chaitanya Charitamrita that comes to mind? Kiba Bipra, Kiba Nyasi.
Yeah.
Shudra.
Kiba Bipra, Kiba Nyasi, Kena Sudra Hoy, Ye Krishna Veda Tattva Seguru. It doesn't matter, Kiba Vipa, if you're a Brahmin, Kiba Nyasi, a sannyasi, Kena Sudra Hoy, whether you're a Sudra, Ye Krishna Veda. If you know science, you realize and understand the science of God, then you can be a teacher.
Okay, so that was one thing they said, absolutely fascinating. The other thing that came to mind is that there is a difference, though, wearing those robes and wearing the clothes I'm wearing. I can walk down the street, I can be invisible.
Right.
I'm dressed like this. Nobody needs to know, you know, what my faith is, what my yoga path is.
Right.
And that's both good and bad, because it means that there's the temptation, at least, I'm speaking from my own experience now, of deviating from that path because, you know, I'm not noticeable.
Right.
You're dressed in a way, everything you do is noticeable. See, people see you. You walk down the street... You know, there was this great story that George Harrison used to tell when he would be walking down the streets of London with Shyam Sundar. And he said it was the first time in his life that people were looking at him, not at George. So everything you do is visible.
Yeah.
Okay. So the other question that we touched on when we were talking before class began was the variety of devotional experiences that have started to emerge, especially in New York, where every night of the week, practically, there's something you can be going to. There's a kirtan going on, there's a lecture going on, there's some kind of a retreat somewhere. So that's a big change from when you and I were lads. And you know, there really wasn't much happening outside of the one Krishna temple there might have been in the city.
Yeah.
But along with that variety comes... some shift of definition of what it means to be devotional. At least that's an issue that challenges me all the time. You know, how far is too far? How far do we go to kind of amalgamating the material world and the spiritual world? The life, back in those days, and we're talking now, you know, late 60s, early 70s, you were either in or you were out. You were either on the path, living a temple life, an ashram life, and, you know, chanting rounds every day on beads, and that was your main occupation. Or else you weren't, and that was some kind of second-class citizenship. That's not the case now.
When I first kind of visited a temple, somehow or other, I didn't actually, because of that line that was drawn, and people don't realize how deep that line
was. It was a straight line.
It was like you were in or you were out. There was nothing in between. So for that reason, I didn't join the ashram for 4 years. I met devotees in 1970. I went back to the college, graduated college then. It was in my last year of master's degree. And then some friend invited me to do something. I visited a temple and my guru was there. And then they engaged me in painting one room. So I was painting one room, and then someone came and said, Prabhupada is upstairs and he's giving everyone some prasadam. And they said all the devotees could come. So when he said all the devotees could come, because I had a mustache, I didn't know if I was a devotee, because devotees were shaved head. So I said, can I also come? And they said to me, yeah, you can also come. They didn't say I was a devotee. So it was that kind of strict line in that sense. And
do you mind me asking what you studied in college? What was your major?
I had a BA in philosophy, and I was on my last years of a master's in education.
So you were on track to become a teacher?
Yeah.
So you made it.
Some people say.
We're going to open this up to questions, so be thinking about what it is you'd like to ask Dhanadhar Swami. One of the big, two things arise very often at these weekly Sunset Gita gatherings. The one, I would say, of the top 10 issues that come up regularly, in the number one slot is relationships. That's number one. I almost kind of feel like head and shoulders above all the others. The next is how do you maintain a devotional yoga mindset living in New York? That's another topic that comes up quite often. Then there's relationships again, number three. And then where does bhakti fit in the larger issues of the world? What is the difference, what is the contribution that we're meant to make as bhakti yogis, in the world around us? And I'm wondering whether that's an issue that's arisen for you. You do a number of retreats and you give classes once a month over at Yoga Maya and so on.
Yeah. Well, I'll just talk first about what I think my role is, and then I'll talk a little bit about bhakti. People need good ideas. They need good ideas. And in our tradition, good ideas come in a tradition of good ideas. Time tested. You need good ideas. If you don't have good ideas, you won't have good thoughts. And as I studied also the Yoga Sutra, and I teach the Yoga Sutra, what is your mind made of? The good mind is made up of good thoughts. They're called aklishta vritti. And if you have good thoughts, it molds your mind to a higher level of perception and contentment. If everything is about happiness, no matter what people do, their goal is happiness. First of all, it's an inner vision that they have. It's the nature of their mind. So I think the most important role in society is people who can represent good ideas and good thoughts. And the reason why I feel very gratified traveling around the city and holding kind of discussions and sanghas, and my experience is if people have good ideas, or let's just take in yoga, ahimsa, right? That's the first, yama. If you give people good ideas and they can think about them, and I think that's what these classes are for, they think about it, they'll develop good thoughts.
And one great saint in Vrindavan, and it's in Raghunath Swami's book, Journey Home, Ramesh Baba. And I once visited him. He's such a saintly person. Every visit him, he's available. And he said it may be a famous thing, from good thoughts come good actions, from good actions come good habits, from good habits come good character, from good character come good destination. So traditionally in Indian society, one of the most important roles is people who develop the qualities to be able to learn and to teach. So I think, practically, I think it's very important. And we see that so many things are going on, but this is what's missing. I give the example of my family. Naturally when I joined, they were kind of so opposed. But after so many years, when my father looked at me, and I have a younger brother, 6 years younger, I have an older brother, 2 years older, and he looked at me, and he's from Brooklyn, and he said in the local vernacular, in kind of a complimentary way to me, he said, I have 3 sons, and you're the only one with his head screwed up, right? So what I felt, okay, why? Because I got good ideas. I got some kind of time-tested knowledge that can be applied and help me develop my character and things. So as far as I could see, that's an important role in society. And those good ideas, in a proper tradition, the good ideas relate to any facet of life that one has. It relates, to whether you're a businessman, or whether you're a family man, or whether, you need some good understanding.
I want to drill down on that just for a minute. We talk about it started with good thoughts. Right? That's the beginning.
Good ideas. Because the thoughts, you may have an idea, but when it becomes your thought,
okay,
you embrace that thought.
But it's something that happens in the mind.
Yeah.
Right? I have an idea that comes to
you
mind.
You hear something.
Yeah.
And if it's kind of touches you,
right,
and you understand it, you can apply it. Yeah.
All right, but so it seems like there's an option there. You can go one of at least 2 ways and maybe more. That an idea comes to mind, and then you have to judge it. You have to decide if
right.
this is a good idea or not a good idea.
Right.
And the criteria on which to judge those ideas would be what?
The criteria on who judges the ideas.
Well, if an idea comes to my mind,
yeah,
and let's say I'm trying to cultivate that devotional life.
Yeah.
So idea comes to mind that, like to try something, want to do this one.
Yeah.
And then before it becomes action, before I act on that idea, there has to be some barometer, some kind of criteria by which I can evaluate that idea.
Yeah.
So where do I find it?
Okay, let's just take an example of a yoga teacher, right? And there's a science of yoga, right? How to do yoga in a proper way. And people come here to learn Jiva Mukti. There are people that are teachers connected to a tradition. So that's one way to get a good idea. And then, by following that tradition, you begin to get the fruits of that knowledge. So, that's one way. I did major in philosophy, so sometimes I'm a little bit philosophical, but there's 3 ways to determine whether something is a good, correct, right? One, you have direct experience of it. It's logical. Or it comes from an authority that you accept.
All right, so wait, those 3 things again are direct experience.
Yeah, how do you determine something is true? You direct experience. Mm-hmm. It's logical. You may not see it, but it makes sense.
Okay.
And then the other one is either called agama or shabda brahman. You're hearing from an authority in a particular subject.
Okay.
So, in the Indian tradition, generally, they accept that there are traditions of knowledge,
mm-hmm.
and that if you learn and study in those and apply it and realize it, it'll be confirmed within you that this is a particular valuable truth.
Mm.
And if you can help another person understand it, then they get that same benefit.
A few times now you've mentioned the importance of study.
Yeah.
I want to just ask you about that. My own tendency, I tend to be somewhat liberal you know, as both in academic environments as well as here at Jiva Mukti. I don't insist on a lot of homework.
Right.
You know, I don't insist on a lot of book learning.
Right.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing when you're trying to cultivate bhakti?
Well, I think in anything you're going to learn, it first comes from hearing. So it may not be book learning, but people, let's say in your class here, people are hearing you. And the only reason they're coming back that here is that there are some good ideas. And, you know, maybe they come from you directly, or maybe they come from the group, or you facilitate them. But somewhere or another, people are coming here because they're learning something. And then when they learn something, it somehow has some practical value in the application of their life. I mean, but I'm just saying, I see me and my brothers, I was thinking, what's the difference?
Mm-hmm.
And I have some kind of understanding and knowledge. Why? Because I had a teacher.
Right. But you've studied this deeply.
Yeah.
I mean, you've studied the texts, you know the philosophy, you can
right.
quote from source materials.
That's
from my there's understanding, it's been
just,
very important.
There's more than just study. I give you one example. Is I hold a retreat every year in India, right? A very beautiful retreat in Jagannath Puri. And this old saint comes every year. He calls me up, and he's probably in this tradition the most learned person in the tradition. I mean, in so many ways, about 85, and practiced. So he came to the retreat one day, and some of the people that attend these retreats are these young people that study in this Sanskrit school in Vrindavan, where I live. So he sees them in front, right? And he says, who is Shastra Gya? Shastra-gya, I mean, who knows these sacred teachings, right? And then he went like this, one who practices. So I don't think it's just book learning. And I think if you approach those, because anything can be used for power.
Mm.
So if you have the wrong motive and you study, it can make you more proud. You know, so I mean, it's not just study. There's knowledge there, but it's actually the mood of service. I mean, the mood of transformation. I mean, if someone approaches good teachings to be transformed, then they'll learn something. But I don't think it's the amount of verses or things like that that you learn. That makes sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let me open this up. Who's got some questions they'd like to ask? Akayani?
How is it different from Guru Shastra Sayur?
What's that?
How is it different from Guru Shastra Sayur? Because you were talking about the verification of knowledge or the sources of knowledge.
Yeah.
So that's something that I've heard for years. It's important to verify with those three sources.
Yeah.
So the question is, there's a tradition of Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra as a way of knowing knowledge is balancing between the teacher and the...
I should say something else, that in the bhakti tradition, right, a person, you know, you need to be faithful to learn. That's one thing.
Faith
is the precursor of knowledge, because unless you have trust in what you hear...
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to make two points. Unless you have trust in what you hear, why are you going to make the effort to understand it? You know, it takes some time to understand something. So even people come here, right? Even though I know you have a very liberal approach and it's kind of collegial in many ways, but they have some trust. You know, otherwise, why would they come? And when you say something, they're going to try to figure it out. But the other thing is thoughtful. You have to be thoughtful. You know, you have to... You are in any tradition of understanding. You have to. If you're not thoughtful, then what's going to happen is even if you have like a teacher, and they really are an authority in a particular subject, you're going to accept things that may be against your conscience, maybe against your morality, maybe against your understanding. Not because the teacher is wrong. if you trust that teacher, because we filter things in so many ways. Mm-hmm. So it's absolutely required that people doubt, that they ask questions to learn.
Hmm. Fascinating. Thank you. Other questions?
Yogeshwar, just because I'm interested. This is Sandra from Croatia.
Welcome. Welcome. Yes?
I want to know. Oh,
in terms of a question.
Oh, did that answer your question?
No, I want to say that she said, you know, generally in the tradition, they say there's a test. It's not just that the guru can say anything. But if it doesn't make sense, he has to meet the standard that where is this in the sacred teachings? And what do the other saintly people say? So it's not just that someone can be a spiritual teacher and then say something and then all of a sudden it doesn't make sense to you and then you just have to, you know, it has to be verified. If you have any, if it's not, if you don't understand it, then there should be, where is it in the sacred books, the sacred teachings? Where is it in the other saintly people?
I want to come back to you in just one second, but that raises another issue, which is that so many of the circumstances of the world that we live in are very current, and they're not necessarily found in the texts. They're not necessarily, you know, recombinant DNA engineering was not an issue in, you know, the high days of the Vedic culture.
Right.
And therefore, the ethics of trademarking genes and creating limbs from, you know, stem cells. Those were not issues that had to be dealt with before. So how do we address some of those more contemporary issues if you can't just go to a text and find an answer?
Well, first of all, you have to understand what the contemporary issue is. If you don't understand it, then you shouldn't speak. For example, there's one very learned scholar, he comes here, Satyanarayan Baba. You know him. He's an old friend of mine for so many years. Someone asked him a question, like, on, you know, what this Western philosopher said that. He said, well, I don't understand Western philosophy. You know, I don't understand their language yet. So you have to be a little conservative on what you comment on, that you first have to understand it. But if you do understand it, you know, if it is a field that you can't comment on, you know what I'm saying? Then the teachings, you should be able to apply them, you know, to the particular certain. In other words, there's a principle involved, and you should be able to extract the principle in whatever your teachings are and apply it to this circumstance once you understand what it is. So if they say it's trademark and something like that, your tradition, if you have that kind of conviction, I mean, what our conviction is that Vedas means knowledge. You know, so the conviction is that it's kind of the image of God. You know, the universe comes out, begins with sound. God said, "Let there be light," and with the same sound that creates the universe, there's knowledge in terms of its relevance. So the conviction of someone in the tradition who kind of follows these teachings and applies it. Yes, this knowledge, this whole body of knowledge in it. Then the question is then you have to see which principle applies. Mm-hmm. And the confidence is it speaks to the world. Mm-hmm. You know, you just have to be able to apply it. And as one time our good friend Borijan, right, and he taught, you know, there's principles and there's details. You know, there's principles of truth. You know, and then there's details how they apply. So you have to be very intelligent.
You're reminding me the last time that I saw Satyanarayan Baba here in New York, he gave me a chance to interview him about ecology in Vrindavan. The sacred rivers and forests and other lands of India are falling prey to industrial waste and pollution and all of the other environmental dangers that we're familiar with here in the West. And the question is, how does that compromise the spirituality, for example, of the Ganges River? If the Ganges River is polluted, or the Yamuna River, which flows by Krishna's village, Vrindavan, it's a dead river. From a scientific, chemical point of view, that water is dead. You can't drink it, you can't bathe in it. And there was a time when it was pristine and beautiful. And so, you know, the debate is, has Yamuna now become material? Is Yamuna contaminated? Or is it something else going on and Yamuna remains pure? And what it came down to for Satyanarayan Baba...
To see what he said.
Well, one thing is, he was very wistful about it. He says he remembers when he was a child going with his parents to sacred rivers around India and how much joy it gave him to bathe with his family in these sacred rivers. It was, you know, the spiritual equivalent of Disneyland. And you'd go to the Saraswati, the Ganges, the Yamuna, and take your sacred bath there. He says, today, you can't touch it. It's poison. And in that sense, supporting environmental causes becomes a spiritual imperative, not just a good idea, but a spiritual imperative, part of our devotional makeup, because the world itself is a manifestation of Krishna. These rivers are the veins running through the body of the universal form. And how can we talk about loving God if we pollute God's creation? So he was bringing in a place of harmony between environmental concepts and the deep theology of the Bhakti texts. And it was beautiful. Very beautiful. What's your name? And ask your question.
Jeanette.
Jeanette.
How can you unify your inner force? Okay. It's at least from our tradition, I can speak, that we're consciousness. That's what we are. We're consciousness, and consciousness achieves its fruition in love. So, and bhakti means Swasmin Parama Prema Rupa. What is bhakti? Bhakti is Parama. It's the form of the topmost love for everything. We're part of something greater than ourselves. So if we want to unify, or unify means to be in harmony, just like the hand. You can say, how can I unify my hand? So unifying your hand means what? You're connecting it with what it's part of, the body, and you're serving the body. So in other words, we're part of something greater than ourselves. So how can you unify that force that forces your consciousness to connect it with the supreme consciousness? And that's bhakti. That's love. And then bhakti, bhakti means the inclination within us for love and loving God. And it comes out in association with objects and of devotion.
How to be harmony with.
What do you want to be unified with? You want to feel whole within yourself?
Yeah, you can say that. And also, because so much destruction in the world,
yeah.
If I believe that if we can unify our inner beings, you know, whatever in our heart, mind, spirit, and soul, come as one, will be manifesting the transform the world, will be everything, will be, as you said, harmony, you know, like that. But how to do that? We have to start from inner being first in order to apply it into the outer world, you know. So I want to know, how can I reach that stage to be unified?
You want to be in harmony?
Yeah.
You want to be in harmony?
Harmony or unified?
What's that?
Yeah. Harmony or unified? I think harmony is in the being that we have the mind, the always in the feeling.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
Maybe the first question would be, why are we not in harmony? And then we can figure out how to get back to that. Where are we now that we're not unified? How did we get not unified? Why? What is it that has disunified us?
Okay.
Yeah? Would that be a fair
maybe
question?
Would be a better,
One time, my teacher was asked the question, what's the difference between a human being and an animal? Right? So then he said, a human being can ask the question, why am I suffering? And when you ask the question, why am I suffering, then you have to say, what did I do wrong? Because what is suffering? Suffering means that when you go against nature, that's when you suffer. When you go against your nature, you suffer. Suffering means you go against nature, just like in the body, right? What's disease? In Ayurveda, the Indian system of medicine, it says that disease is a crime against nature. When you go against your nature, like your nature is to have a certain amount of whatever it is and you take too much. So, if you say, why am I suffering? Then you have to ask the question, what did I do wrong? Then you have to ask the question, what should I be doing? Right? Then you have to ask the question, what am I? So if you want to be in harmony with everything else, you first have to understand what you are. And therefore, the most important question is self-realization, understanding what you are. Okay? And in our tradition, in the bhakti tradition, what we are is we're a particle of consciousness of the supreme consciousness, and the harmony of the part with the whole is serving it. So you'll be in harmony, you'll feel whole, right, when you serve God, when you serve something that's greater than yourself. So in the answer to your question, if you want to feel whole, you want to be in harmony, you have to serve.
Okay. Serve, you mean through God's way, through God's purpose, or how to serve
that you're
talking about?
How to serve.
I think you need to explain to her the process of devotional service, which begins with chanting and the beauty and all these different things. I mean, you take it for granted, but it's really mysterious for a lot of people.
Right, I wonder if that's a lot to explain right now.
Well, I want to play gadfly here, which is my usual role.
Okay. Yeah.
Why is it always that we did something wrong and now we're suffering? I mean, you know, is that really necessary? You know, is it necessary that we're always the ones to blame? I mean, isn't it possible that, natural catastrophes are not the result of something that I did? Or, you know, maybe, something's happening in the larger world that's not my fault, you know. I'm saying this because a lot of people have asked me this question, you know, namely, why is it always that there's some, you know, we're kind of burdened by this sense of guilt and responsibility that we're suffering because of something we did, right? And is that necessary? To come to some spiritual higher realization of ourselves, do we really have to go into that kind of dark place where, we're the worst thing to happen, you know, and it's my fault? Is that necessary? You know, that do I have to somehow fess up to being this, you know, faulty creature before I can?
Well, in Indian philosophy, all schools, they accept one thing. They agree on one thing. All schools agree on one thing. And they all agree in the law of karma. I mean, if talking from an Indian perspective, they all believe in the law of karma. And the law of karma thinks that there's the way the world moves around us, right, is for us. And therefore, there's a great distinction in that type of tradition between suffering and unhappiness. You know, people suffer. In other words, things don't go their way. But there's not an absolute correlation between that and your inner self and your inner being.
Mm.
But in terms of just why people what suffering itself is, you know, or unhappiness is within ourselves. It's not what's happening around us. It's our consciousness. You know, it's not, it doesn't mean that because things are going around us that we have to be, you know, things are moving in ways which are not pleasant for us in one sense, and we have to be unhappy. Happiness is an inner sense.
So in other words, regardless of what the background may be, karmic spillover into this life from things we've done previously or whatever, the issue is how do we relate to that and what do we do with it? That's an interesting distinction between those two things. I don't know whether your question has gotten answered, but it's a very profound question. So why don't we just give it a minute and we'll let some other people have a chance to ask Dhanadhara Swami what they may have on their mind, and perhaps we can come back to that even afterwards.
Sure.
Thank you. Oh, I see the connection you're making. You're saying that that's not the only way that someone might come to
seek a
spiritual path. It's right around this time when some of my more cunning friends would say, yeah, well, you know, but why was it necessary to set the rules up quite so stridently? Why did Krishna have to make it so difficult? If it's his ball, he can make the rules.
Well,
right? So why is it necessary that in order for us to come to this point of finding the inner unity that we seek, the ultimate happiness that we seek, that there has to be such intense suffering? Okay, so there needs to be some motive, something to spur us to want to know something about the greater mystery of life or some deeper dimension of ourselves. Was it necessary to set things up in such a way that the suffering would be so intense? I mean, couldn't we have come to the path of bhakti, you know, without having to go through all of the Sturm und Drang?
The way I look at it is this: if you think of a person that you have a close relationship with, right, and think of something in that person that you want to change, right, why don't you just tell them? Right? That would be the easiest thing, just tell them. But we see that people don't understand things. They need experiences to understand things. So if you look at this world as like an evolvement, people are evolving in consciousness, or that's the objective of the world, then we need all kinds of experiences. And it's really, really hard for us to figure out what experiences we need. I give another example of my own spiritual path. Every single year since I've been in this, at a particular time of the year, I say, yeah, now I see the truth. I have a view. The way I look, everything, I see the truth. Then inevitably what happens is something happens, and I go, oh my God, I never realized that before. And then I walk around for another year, and then I'm thinking, and then the next year. And every year it happens. And what that indicates to me is to actually see truth and actually evolve to a higher level of consciousness, right? It takes a lot. And I'm appreciating the divine for giving me all these kind of variety of experiences that I needed to come to a higher level of consciousness. Mm-hmm. And I think in those type of cultures, what you actually value, right, is not how the, you know, not how the world moves to conform to your desires, but how you move to conform to a, you know, the will of God. In other words, it's all about consciousness. So if you look at it about consciousness, then you're not like making your judgment. I give there's even an example that was given. I read that the other day. There's a guy, a person named Dan Gilbert. He's a psychologist, and he did studies, and amazing studies. He did lottery winners and quadriplegics. And after 5 years from that event, they each had the same level of happiness.
Quadriplegics,
they had
the lottery
experience.
Winners.
At the beginning, the lottery winners were ecstatic, and someone who became a quadriplegic was depressed. But after 5 years, there was no difference in their quotient of happiness. In other words, happiness is not the how the world's moving around us and the external things. It's an inner sense. And we tend to judge that what's happening to us externally, you know, it's unhappy because it's not conforming to the way I want the world to move.
Okay.
But when you actually study it from a spiritual tradition, or you even study it from the standpoint of psychology, what happiness is actually something quite different.
Now, look, this comes back to your question. Is it Jennifer?
Jeanette.
That maybe that unity that we're seeking inside is not a question of what something you have to do or some place you have to go, but revisiting the life we already have on a deeper level. I mean, you really struck a chord for me, because I know for myself what it's like to have family or friends or people I love and who are hurting themselves, and I want to tell them what they're doing wrong. And I know I can't. That saying it is not going to make the difference.
And you know, if they would learn these things, how much better they would be.
That's what's so painful about it.
What will they have to experience to learn them?
Yeah.
And sometimes, it's a frustration sometimes.
Yeah. Very frustrating.
I mean, for them also. And a lot of times, even that 12-step process, you know, the Alcoholics Anonymous and things like that. The first step is kind of you feel yourself helpless. So a lot of times our own consciousness and difficulties bring us to that point. And that's the point where we can actually evolve to a higher being in consciousness. I mean, I know you deal with this because you just told me you're writing a book on, you know, this famous Holocaust survivor. You know, and I'm from also a Jewish family. I was with my relatives about 5 years ago, and my niece asked me, you know, do you believe in the law of karma? You know, then what about the Holocaust? And the thing, there are tough questions. And there's a whole school of philosophy called theodicy, where they try to reconcile the suffering of the world, you know, with the existence of God. But my answer to them, first of all, it's not just the Jews. Everyone. You know, so it's a real question. But my own conviction, at least for my own life, is that once you have a little bit of a spiritual perspective, then you learn that everything that happens to you was connected to trying to evolve you to a higher state of inner happiness by a deep understanding.
Yeah, I find this whole area of exploration absolutely fascinating. Some other hands? Michael, you had a question?
Okay, I'll ask. I was in a workshop about 2 weeks ago. And
you were what?
I was in a workshop about 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
and I was a devotee, and the teacher said that we choose the birth we have, or we're given the birth we have, based on what we want to have in this life. Meaning that we are jealous of God, which is why we're born on this earth. And because of that, because we want to be God, is why we are who we are. Because what we want gets fulfilled, that leads to suffering because we're jealous of God. And can you elaborate that?
It's really, you know, because I have to say, and I'm not sure what the frame of reference in the audience is, so sometimes it's a little difficult to answer questions, you know, but I would say one thing is just take God out of the picture for a second, right? And, you know, basically, in this kind of concept, suffering would be trying to be the center rather than serving the center. So if that's kind of a God type thing, because you put yourself in a position where you can't experience love. Once you're in that consciousness that I'm in the center and I want to conform the world to my desires, and that what happiness will be is in the future, when all the world is lined up completely again, then of course you'll be suffering.
Yeah.
Because you're not in a position of love, and that's what suffering is. I mean, you can be the wealthiest man in the world, if you don't have love in your heart, you're not happy. Right? So, yeah, in one sense. I mean, if you want to look at it from a theistic perspective, yeah, there's some kind of play going on here that you have ego. The whole Vedic culture is to get rid of ego. And what is ego? It's that conception that I'm in the center. So yeah, the world, that's what's causing all the problems, and the world is mercifully moving you out of the center. So, I mean, yeah, I can see that perspective.
So the deep, profound, mystic message of all the sacred texts is get over yourself.
Yeah, I would call it self-overcoming.
Yeah, okay.
Even I had a nice discussion with actually a philosophy professor, and he had just studied Confucius, and he was really excited about Confucius, and he was very surprised because he talked a lot about ritual, and he was like independent, intellectual, you know, but they were talking about ritual, but the definition that Confucius gave, he really liked. He said, ritual means conform yourself to something higher than yourself. You know? And then looking at it that way, and I started to think in the bhakti process, right, the importance of family, the importance of community. Because what happens when you actually enter into a partnership or a family, right? All of a sudden the world's not about you. All of a sudden you have to conform yourself, hopefully, to a desire, right, for a unit rather than the individual. And I thought, why community is so important too.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Because unless you kind of have that, you never experience love. So and he used the word self-overcoming. Mm-hmm. You know, all these things, self-overcoming. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think it's
beautiful
the concept. Essence.
Yeah.
The essence is to yeah. suffer. And we can say that too, even we have so much faith in it, or I do, or you do, in a theistic tradition, when we don't see that self-overcoming, we don't see our tradition, really. We don't see bhakti. We don't see devotion. If all of a sudden someone... And I read this other thing. It was so interesting. It was actually by an American cardinal. And he was talking about the difference between crowds and community. And he said, crowds is a bunch of self-interested people that are always competing in a conflict. You know, and a community is people that accept an ideal higher than themselves. Self-overcoming. What do you say, self?
Well, getting over yourself?
Getting over yourself.
Fascinating. Well, speaking of ritual, we end our Tuesday gatherings with an artsy ceremony. And
this is certainly a committing of ourselves to something greater than ourselves, since the Artsy ceremony is an offering back to the source of creation, the elements of creation. So it's about time for the Artsy. And then we, those of you who haven't been here before, we have usually some vegan treat as an excuse for sitting down and kind of making new friends. So what do we have this evening as a treat?
It's a vegan banana bread with chocolate chips.
Oh, yes, yes. Always tempting. Great. Thank you, Cher, for
being here. Can I say something about Artsy?
Yeah, please.
Someone told me this about Artsy in terms of self-overcoming. Mm-hmm. Describe it. There are five elements, right? There's earth, water, fire, air, ether, right? So earth is the only element that has fragrance. None of the other elements have fragrance. So incense means, you know, it's tantra. Tantra means you take matter and you transfer it to spirit. So it means this earth, which I enjoy for myself, now I'm offering in love to God. Then there's water. Water has taste.
We're talking about the elements of the Artsy, by the way. So if you're ready to... You're going to do the Artsy?
Unless somebody else wants to do it, I'm happy. I'm always happy to share the Artsy.
Can I explain this or two?
No, this is great. So the earth has fragrance.
The earth has all the five earth you can feel, touch, see, smell, hear. Right?
And taste.
And taste. Right? But none of the other elements have fragrance, so it's kind of unique. So the incense represents the earth is offered to God. Then water has taste, right? The other elements are fire, ether, and air. They don't have taste. Water, you can see, you can feel, you can touch, you can taste. So you're offering the water. Then fire, fire you can't taste, you can't smell. Fire you can see, right? You can see fire. And you can touch fire and you can hear fire. So then we offer that. Then we offer fire. Then there's the five gross elements. Then there's
air.
Air, right? So air you can touch and you can hear.
You can't see it.
What?
You can't taste it.
You can't taste it. You can't see it. You can't smell it. So air. So then the air is the peacock fan, mm-hmm. right? And then there's the ether. The only thing in ether is you can hear it. So it's the most subtle. So they say sometimes the chamara, which is kind of very, very more subtle. So, I mean, the basic idea is with the ritual, is now this world... which you put yourself in the center of, now you're offering it to something higher than you.
That's beautiful. That's a more detailed explanation, I think, than we've ever had before of the Artsy ceremony.
I hope it's not too detailed.
Would you please join me in thanking Dhanadhar Swami for joining us here this evening? Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us. And so maybe while we have Artsy, you could lead us in a kirtan again.
Okay.
How does that sound?
That's great.